Hi, I'm Jason Wacob, founder and co-CEO of MindBodyGreen, and your host for the MindBodyGreen podcast, where I'll be bringing you deep and insightful dialogues with some of the greatest minds in wellness. If you like what you hear, please consider giving us a 5-star review and comment. And don't forget to visit us at MindBodyGreen.com for your daily dose of wellness, and make sure to check out all of our great offerings, including our online classes and trainings. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Jason Wacob, founder and CEO of MindBodyGreen, the best-selling author of Wealth, and your host for the MindBodyGreen podcast, where I'll be bringing you deep and insightful dialogues with some of the greatest minds in wellness. If you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star review, comment, and share with your friends and family. And don't forget to visit us at MindBodyGreen.com for your daily dose of wellness. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. We're going to talk all things brain health with Dr. Dean and Dr. Aisha Sherzai, a husband and wife team of doctors and directors of the Alzheimer's Prevention Program at Loma Linda University Medical Center and best-selling authors of The Alzheimer's Solution. They are true thought leaders in how to prevent neurodegenerative disease with lifestyle changes. Dean, Aisha, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
We are so happy you're here. You know, you guys were at our Revitalize event earlier this year and really had the whole audience captivated and really, really mind-blowing stuff. And I encourage everyone to listen to our talk. But one of the things when we did that interview, we started out with this statistic, which is frightening and hits home personally for me and a lot of people. And it's this crazy statistic that almost half the people who live to age 85, 47%, will have Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. Scary.
It is. It's the fastest growing epidemic in the United States and most of the world, in fact. And it's a quiet epidemic because we don't hear as much as we should. I mean, given that it's after the age of 65, 10%, and doubles every decade. Until 85, it's at age 85, you have 50% who have dementia. And that's massive. You know, it's more massive if you take into consideration that the fastest growing population in America is 85 and above. That population is growing 4 times faster than those 65 and above, 65 to 85. And that population is growing twice as fast as everybody else. Now, everybody's seen the pyramid of aging. Everybody, you know, the bottom of the pyramid, the widest area is usually there, the people in their 20s and 30s. And that's been the case for millions of years. That pyramid is about to turn upside down. We now have a greater percentage of population who's older than 40. And that number is going to grow more and more. So you will have more people above the age of 40 than below. That's never been seen. And that number has grown so rapidly that there's a statistic, these are statisticians who come up with these numbers, that more than 70% of all the individuals that have ever lived past the age of 70 are alive now. Ever. So we're seeing this incredible growth, and it's wonderful. We have 80,000 centenarians in the United States alone. Those are people over the age of 100. And that number is going to go to 600,000 by 2050. Centenarians. So we have to address this because we're aging. And we're aging well in many ways, but 50% are experiencing dementia.
Wow. So one of the things that was definitely really interesting and won over the crowd at Revitalize, you know, it's easy to go down the road of diet. Everyone said, okay, plant-based diet, get it, and so forth. But when asked, you know, what's the number one thing we can do for our brain health? I loved your answer, and it was purpose. Talk more about that. Why purpose?
I guess it's the glue that binds everything together. It centers all the other elements together. Yeah, obviously nutrition is important. Obviously exercise is important, and we can talk about it for hours. There's a lot of data. But what comes back over and over again when you look at the healthiest places in the world, when you look at different populations that have been followed, it has to be purpose. It has to be that drive, that vector that allows people to focus the importance of all the other elements on it, whether it's nutrition, exercise, or stress management. And it's that energy that pushes everything forward. And the lack of it makes everything else meaningless.
When we did this book, we have this acronym NEURO. It's a little gimmicky, cute acronym, but it's good. It helps give people a perspective. At the center of it is you. So unwind. But what is that? It's stress management, or tension management. Life needs tension. Life is tension. Anything that's not moving, that's not creating that potential, or in physics, potential or kinetic energy, it's not alive. Our cellular structure is a potential energy. Everything is. So to say that I'm going to eliminate stress, sorry, I just tapped. it's erroneous.
I agree.
Stress
is always with you.
It is.
Your problems don't change. Your problems don't go away. They just change.
Exactly. But the kind of stress is important. I mean, as much as we would like to talk about nutrition, and it's been our life, our PhDs, our research, we went to Loma Linda for this, but sadly or fortuitously, the most important factor in brain health and life health and is good stress. So what is good stress?
Well, what's good stress and good purpose?
Yes.
People always love to measure things like, okay, like what's good purpose? How do I do this? Like the great thing about diet is like, okay, like this is how much spinach or kale I ate. This is how much, like it's very easy to measure. You can take your bloods and so forth. And it's like, okay, I'm making progress. But like, how do you measure, like, what's good purpose? What's good stress?
Good purpose. So this is the thing. I say that we have to welcome complexity in life. I think most of the problems in the world is when we try to find things in simplicity. And the world is not that. So we have to find comfort in discomfort, comfort in complexity. And it's a little complex in the sense that it's not the gimmick. It's not the vitamin. It's not this, that. Purpose or good purpose or good tension is that which is driven by what you love. And that doesn't have to be something that it can change. But it's the thing that drives you. It gives you motivation. It is a light at the end of the tunnel. It has something that was connected to your past. It is something to connect it to a higher meaning in life. And that becomes what I've defined consciousness. It becomes the biggest island of consciousness for you. And that island of consciousness is the one that actually connects you to everything else. So I had a patient who wasn't talking for months because of she had mild dementia but then had infection. And in the clinic, in the wards, we do, rounds. We rounded, and the residents would say, quickly go to the next patient. I said, no, tell me about her. We'll call her, Ms. Collins. And they said, don't worry, her potassium is this, sodium. I said, no. Tell me about her. After much search, they found out that she was a piano teacher for 60 years. And I said, okay, Ms. Collins. And the residents are getting a little irked. Ms. Collins, who's the best... Who was the greatest composer? And of course, she's not talking. She's looking through, and the residents are getting a little tense. And I did it again. And by the third time, I see a flicker. And this person that has not spoken in months, in a very slight voice, says, "What a stupid question." Mozart or Beethoven? What is a stupid question? But that's purpose. When you connect everything around that one thing. It doesn't have to be grandiose, but it's yours. It gives you direction. It gives you purpose. It could be volunteering. It could be music. It could be running an organization like yours where you're changing the world. It could be, but it's got to be yours, and it's got to actually have a vector, and it should have series of successes. That's not easy. That's not the pill off the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if people focus on that, if people focus on finding that, and they don't have to make it well circumscribed. Oh, I'm going to stick to this. It can change over time. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the whole purpose of growth. That creates everything else. Everything else can be connected to that. Your nutrition can be connected to that. Your exercise, your meditation, everything can be connected to that. Otherwise, it becomes little islands that are fleeting from moment to moment, from event to event, from talk to talk. But there has to be a central anchor of purpose, which is what we found repeatedly in these healthy places where we are in Loma Linda, and where we have, you know, the people that live the longest but also healthiest, it's not because they took the vitamins concoction or this or that. They had every one. I mean, I hate to be bombastic. Almost every one of them had a purpose that they can actually tell you right away, that this was my life purpose. That's the beauty.
And there's no, and purpose is something that's free.
Yes.
Doesn't, you don't need money to find purpose.
Mm-hmm. And from a practical purpose, it changes. It changes from age to age. It doesn't have to be a static thing. A lot of people, when they visit us, and you know, we provide this holistic, multifaceted, a comprehensive approach to brain health and mind health and general well-being. You know, finding what the purpose is or finding what that drive and energy is, it changes. And so people have to be comfortable with the notion that it'll take some time to find it. And if it changes, it's okay. One has to be able to shift their life, their tools, and their resources according to what that purpose is. And finding it will take some time.
What do you guys think is a misguided example of purpose?
A misguided example of purpose is one that you read from a book and then you try to follow it.
The cookie cutter approach.
Yeah. Right. You read Dean and Aisha's purpose and you said, that's my purpose, because it sounds so good. It never is. It never is. Because it's complex. Again, complexity. Let's talk about our purpose. Our purpose has changed repeatedly. I mean, when we would sit down with the family, we have Sundays, we have this family gathering, and this comes from Covey's time. I mean,
family
after all,
meetings.
Family meeting, you know, what's our vision statement? To help lower suffering. Okay, that doesn't mean anything. I mean, it's so big, so broad. But that has evolved over time. And now we're doing books and the kids are doing this stuff and it evolves. But that central theme has kept us moving, and the purposes, and again, it could be, have evolved, but it has a direction. But if I would have followed even, you know, whoever, from Maxwell to Covey to, you know, the next person, whatever, this little book that comes out, the next, it would have completely misguided me, because it's not around what I value, my capacities, my strengths, my own weaknesses, my own desires, my past. We have a very, very eclectic past compared to many other people. If I don't have my purpose having an element of all of those, I'm missing parts of my experiences. So it should be yours. It probably the hardest thing is finding that path.
Right.
And it should take time. And I think we should spend more time on that than anything else in life. Because once you find the general direction, the highway, or not even highway, direction, Then it becomes fun, because even if the you take the off-road here, the path less traveled, we love that, as this poet said, then it's fine, it's fun, because it's in the same direction, you know, it's good. But it makes, so let's connect one thing to that. Let's say exercise. So our direction is, she did Columbia, I did NIH and all this stuff, but then we went to Loma Linda, you know. Loma Linda is not the biggest name in the world, but it was the healthiest place in the world. It's the blue zone, the only blue zone in the United States. So we said, we're going to take the risk. And the risk didn't feel like a risk, because it was along our purpose. You know, our mentor said, this is suicide. Didn't turn out that way. It didn't turn out that way. It was wonderful, because it was along that purpose. And even when we did research, it wasn't just a one-off paper. We have to get to 600 publications. No, every paper we did, every publication we did was around that purpose. So it wasn't...
Well, yeah. I think the point is, purpose is about the journey. It's not
about
the destination. It's not like, I'm going here and I did it and now I'm done with purpose and we're moving on to the next thing.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. Yes. As the song goes, it's about the journey and not the destination.
Yeah.
Aerosmith. You just put it.
And what do you think people get wrong about stress management? You were going that direction.
I think the most common thing that we see in the clinics and in the hospital and the communities that we work is when you talk about stress, people envision this life of just, you know, laying on the hammock under the sun and not doing anything.
The picture in Bali, I've got the rose petals, handstand on a beach.
You've seen the calendar pictures, right? Yeah, the palm trees and all that. And then that's not it. That's absolutely not it. As a matter of fact, you know, statistically speaking, people who retire or they stop that complex activity that they have been involved in for years and decades. Once they stop that, they lose that edge. And then you start seeing early signs and symptoms of dementia creeping in. It's a very steep downward decline from there on. And the way we describe stress or the good stress is continue the same complexity and challenge that you were used to, but focus it on an area that you love. So say, for example, you've been an accountant or you worked in a bank and you were involved with paperwork and numbers and you don't want to do that anymore. What was it during your childhood and youth years that you absolutely loved? Dean actually had a lot of, you know, some of his patients work on cars, building car models or similar activities, learning a new language or picking up a volunteering work and continue that. So stress doesn't mean just stopping everything. Right.
Well, is that part of the problem? It's this idea of, you know, I get to retirement, that I'm just done, and then you just start shutting off your brain, and then...
It's very pervasive. It is. The steepest decline of all the curves, I mean, talk about nutrition, exercise, right? The steepest decline is among those who have had a very, very active mental activity throughout their life, be it job or whatever. It's usually actually job complexity. It's not even education. When we do research, we always use education as a proxy, as a side of representation of mental activity or brain reserve. But it's not a good one. I mean, otherwise, poor Bill Gates and Steve Jobs only had a year of college or even. You know,
right.
Yeah, but it's not that. It's mental activity and job complexity. And those people, when they retire and they don't do anything, they have the steepest decline. So the brain works like this. You have about 87 billion neurons. But each neuron, I'm simplifying it, it's more complex, but each neuron can make a few connections, or as many as 30,000 connections. There lies protection. There lies the protection. And what has the greatest effect on that connection? Whereas nutrition creates the good environment, whereas sleep creates the good environment, whereas exercise and mental activity or good challenge or purpose creates the connections, 30,000 connections. Now, so when people compare the brain to muscle, I say, what a disservice to the brain. I mean, the biggest guy you know, I don't even know names, so I always, some muscle bodybuilder, 3 times bigger than average, right? But when your neurons can make 30,000 connections, nothing can sever those. That's actually been shown. That's why looking at the brain just volumetrically makes no sense.
So what's bad complex mental activity? And when is it like too much with technology? So this is something Dave Asprey, I think, was interviewing someone. It was this interesting anecdote where it was like a CEO high performing. And he was like, you know, I think I'm like losing my mind or whatever, dementia. And then the conclusion was, well, like this guy was reading like 3,000 emails a day and this other stuff and like forgetting names of people. But the takeaway from the doctor, which I thought was interesting, is like your brain can only handle so much. So it's like prioritizing like you over this. And like, it's just the idea of, I guess what I'm getting at is like technology. And then which type of complex mental activity is good and what is bad, and technology's role in all of this?
I think one area that we make a big mistake on, especially during our age with technology and, you know, all the stimulus that's around us, is we multitask a lot. And there is no such thing as multitasking. We just do many things poorly. And the concept.
Can we say that again?
Well, there is no such thing as multitasking. it's doing many things poorly. And that's how the brain works. You know, you hear these taglines everywhere, you know, you're only using 10% of your brain capacity, and you have movies where, you know, it shows actually the percentage of the brain from 1 to 10 to 20. Lucy. Yeah, remember Lucy? That was ridiculous. It doesn't work that way. We pay attention to each and every activity 100% of the time. We just do it poorly. And there is a way to focus and concentrate and attend to things better in better ways. How much is too much depends on so many different factors. You know, how much time have you had? What is your brain reserved to begin with? Have you had good sleep? Are you eating good food? Is your brain ready to absorb all that information? And I think for each and every one of us, we ourselves know what is that point where, you know, enough is enough and you can't really do more than that. Nobody can actually tell you. And we all have to get into this habit of identifying that particular point for ourselves.
The gatekeeper of cognition is focus.
I like that one too.
Yeah, the gatekeeper is focus. Meditation is about focus. Mm-hmm. And people don't know how much capacity they have for focus. The one thing that actually is affected first as we age is not memory. Is the focus centers, the posterior cuneate, this part of the brain that's for focus. And actually, the optimal position for that part of the brain is to quiet down. Actually, it gets louder. So focus is critical. And focus builds cognition. You can actually increase IQ. And now we rewrite this thing in psychology today. Hopefully, it will come out soon. Beyond EQ and IQ is XQ. And XQ, extraordinary brain, extraordinary quotient, has nothing to do beyond focus. Multitasking, doing multiple things, overwhelming things, or the things that overwhelm your brain, destroys that focus. So if you want to do more, and if you want to do it really well, build better focus.
So what are some of the best things we can do for focus? Meditation?
Yes. Absolutely.
Yes.
Any type? Or do you just, you know, we've got mindfulness, we've got, you know, we've got TM, we've got mantra, we got every, like what are the...
Whatever works for you.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you.
Yeah. It depends on the personality.
Yes. I agree. I couldn't sit in one spot, as you can tell.
Sure.
I couldn't sit in one spot and meditate. But when I do walking meditation, and a lot of people argue with me that there's no such thing. I said, you don't know what's going on in my brain when I'm doing that. You know, I get deep, deep levels of focus. I mean, something that I would not even fathom as an 18-year-old.
Is driving good?
For meditation?
For focus.
Have you been to LA?
No, but sometimes I don't drive a lot in New York, but when I drive sometimes I find it not cathartic, but I'm focused.
Yeah. Depends on the road, doesn't it? I mean, I know that...
Assume there's no traffic. Yes. It's not the 405. Say we're cruising up the PCH.
Yes. Absolutely. I've had those events. I've had... In D.C., outside, when you go on these highways, it is. I don't know if you can get to too much focus, because then you'll be into the forest, literally.
Well, then you got the radio on. It's like the running. Some people, I forget who said this, but like the problem, like with running, for some people, it's meditation and motion, mm-hmm. It's focus. But the moment you put on the music,
yes,
gone. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah. So I think it depends on the depth you want to achieve. I think the depth you want to achieve with driving, it's a little dangerous.
So what is the prescription for focus? What are the few things everyone can do? Their daily life. Meditation?
Meditation, yes. Or, you know, sometimes some people are intimidated by that word. So finding moments of solitude and silence to hear out what your mind and what your body's telling you. And it can be as small as 30 seconds, 30 to 60 seconds, and building that. We work in the communities. For those of us who are in the trenches, and for people who are, you know, working 3 or 4 jobs just to make ends meet, sure. And they're, you know, experiencing a lot of, you know, problems in life, it's very difficult for them to start on that track. And it always works when you give them hope that they can do it anywhere. Even in the parking lot right before they go to their job, and it can be as little as 30 seconds to a minute. And not to be afraid of losing focus, because that in itself is a strength. The moment you lose focus and you come back and refocus, that's a strong exercise for the brain. Mm-hmm. And to lengthen that period of focus as much as possible is key.
Okay, so we've got purpose, we've got focus, we've got stress. What about sleep?
Oh, goodness. Wow.
Where do we begin?
Yeah, we just wrote a paper on this as well. Sleep is the best, most important, most cleansing part of the day. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a little catch for, you know, how could it be? But it is. I mean, imagine what would it take for evolution to sacrifice safety for you to sleep? I mean, 8 hours a day, you're out. That's not a safe evolutionary process, is it? Why would it sacrifice that? Mm-hmm. Well, because it's an incredible, incredible part of the brain. That's two main functions that we know of. By the way, the only humility we know is of science. And I love if everybody just couches their statement by saying, to the best of our knowledge today. And that's not a weakness. To say to the best of our knowledge and not be absolute about things is a strength.
I agree, yeah.
This is the time that all of us have to start agreeing to that we have to be data-driven, and we have to be okay by saying to the best of our knowledge and not create false failure by. So to the best of our knowledge, there are two things about sleep, and they're magical. I mean, science magical. One is it helps consolidate memory and thought. It actually puts things into right folders and files. Not literally, but places in the brain.
Maybe for me it does.
Yes. It is incredibly organizing. And we know that when you look at the brain function the next day across age, gender, education level, that the function is significantly lower with regards to memory and processing speed if you don't get sleep because of what it does. The second thing that it does is even more important. When we were in Beverly Hills, we were the main brain doctors, and we saw all these patients, and that came wonderful people. And a lot of people would say, I do this cleanse and that cleanse and that's, and I hope nobody gets offended, but we said there's only two cleanses that we know of, data-driven. One is water, and incredibly important, because as we get older, the amount of water in our body goes down from 70% to 60%, and water actually is the medium for all our functions. We need it so the less water means less efficient function. The second cleanse is sleep. We know that during sleep, your inflammatory factors go down, good sleep. That's why we say restorative sleep, not just sleep. I can knock anybody out, but because you knock them out with propofol, it doesn't mean that they have gone through the cycles of sleep. Mm-hmm. The four cycles plus the rapid eye movement, those all have a function. So the sleep has to be restorative sleep. And during that time, there's cleansing. The amyloid, which is the bad protein for Alzheimer's, go down. They've done studies. Inflammatory markers go down. Cortisol levels are modulated, not necessarily go down, but modulated better. Glucose levels are modulated better. Thyroid function is modulated better. It's incredible how much of a modulating, stabilizing, cleansing process sleep is. Then you know why we were left in the cave, knocked out for bears and lions to come and eat us, because the rest of us that survived did very well with this incredible brain that is 3 pounds, 2% of body's weight, but consumes 25% of the energy. There lies the problem. 25% of energy means that you have to give it the right food that doesn't overuse energy. That's a whole different talk.
Sure.
We hear all these foods and I have the mechanism. And we have to use the kind of energy environment that actually helps it clean. And sleep does all of that.
So how much do you need?
7 to 8 hours for adults.
So you don't buy the I can do 4 hours. I'm one of those people. I'm not one of those people.
No, no. And I don't think anybody can function with 4 hours of sleep. And if they say 4 hours, I think they're probably sleeping a little more but not reporting it. For children, it's more, up to 10 hours. And for elderly, it goes down about 6 to 7 hours.
So you mentioned children, and we have a year and a half old, and definitely that has had moments of limiting sleep.
Mm-hmm, of course.
What do you recommend for raising a child and making sure your child has a healthy, excited, interested brain?
Yeah. We have two.
Yes, we've been through that journey.
Yeah, we have one. Alex is 13 and Sophie is 11. And they have been our central focus. and their brain has been our central focus.
You've run tests on them? You've hooked them up, wires on them? Completely.
Yes, yes. And yeah,
they're great kids. Whatever you're doing, it's working. Whatever tests you're doing in the basement in Loma Linda, yes.
It's working.
Well, ironically, coming back to the first statement, I always say that if you want a child to be happy, you have to connect their purpose outside of themselves. Sorry, this might be a little outside.
No, I love it.
Yeah. Because if the purpose is self, the self is never satisfied. You can buy all the I found out about these cars, by the way, in Cedars. Bugattis and Maseratis. And
we just learned
Cedar
these names.
Cedars, yeah. All these exotic cars.
We were the directors of Alzheimer's Prevention Program.
I think we were the only ones who had a Toyota Sienna.
Sienna, yes. Yeah. A very dirty one. But if you connect it to things, it is an infinite hole that will never be filled. So if you connect their purpose to something outside of themselves, you know, environment, animals, the world, suffering and all that, then it becomes...
Religion's handy there too.
Religion's handy there too, yes, yes. We did it to environment and animals and all that. But so it's incredibly important to have that purposeful connection. And then the other thing is stimulus, managing stimulus. Mm-hmm. That's a question we're asked so often. So what video game is good? What's not?
Sure.
It's not good or bad. It's the type. And to simplify, it's about focus. If the stimulus is such that it overstimulates too many factors, it overwhelms the child. They never develop that focus centers. And then the first thing the next psychologist in the school does, give them the type diagnosis that we all know of, ADHD.
Right.
And then add to that a sugary cereal in the morning, and especially a boy who was a hunter-gatherer now has to sit in 35 other kids for 8 hours. You have a perfect diagnosis there, don't you? But stimulus that is focus-centered, even video games. I mean, I'm not against video games. I'm not against games at all. They're incredible for visual spatial capacity, memory, processing. We know that it actually helps with IQ.
So you ever, you know, Adam Gazzelli? Yeah.
Correct. So
interesting work on video games. But the right kind make you smarter.
Right.
And they will. And they will find better ones and better ones and better ones. And even as far as education, the system of education is these blunt. You're throwing this big book here that you just lost them there. I mean, how about in small increments of focus around that person's strength? There are things like Khan Academy and IXL and all. Sure. I'm not going to. That are amazing. So for children, I think focus and purpose serve the same purpose.
Yeah, we underestimate them a lot of times. We think that they probably are not ready to identify their purpose or try to focus on a purpose, but they do at a very young age. And they're able to put that at the center of all of their activities. And that keeps them focused and centered. And that has helped us quite a bit.
So it's safe to say you're neutral on technology? Depends on intent. It depends on quality, how you're using it.
I would say no. I would say I'm very pro-technology. It's like in the 1940s, somebody saying that airplanes are dangerous.
Sure,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, but no.
Well, I'll be more specific. I should have said social media.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Social media is a little different thing. But technology is going to be opening up education. It's going to open up the full capacity of children. I mean, actually, a four-year-old has more neurons than ever in their history, in their life. Then what happens, there's a process called pruning. So there's programmed cell death. And the infrastructure that's left is them. We believe that pruning has two elements. One is genetic. The other is environment. Environment determines how that pruning is done and what's left behind. So I think technology will help us out, but we're not there yet.
One of my favorite answers, actually, Revitalize, I'll never forget this. I said, what about brain fog? And you say, what? And I'm like, what about... it's like, he got me. So like... had to have been there. But so people will describe, you know, this brain fog where they're, you know, just forget where they are. So like what are some of those things like brain fog that people experience during the day where they're just zoning out or lost track?
I think it's multifactorial.
Yeah.
You know, for some people it's just, for a lot of people it's food.
Yeah.
You know, it's the amount of sugar that we consume on a regular basis. And it really does produce that fog. But then it could be because of multitasking. It could be because of lack of sleep. Or it could be a combination of all of these factors. But it's a pretty legitimate thing. And sometimes people don't, because they don't understand the definition, they describe it very well. They describe the specific symptoms of what that essentially means. And for us, it's helping them identify the areas that they're doing wrong and fixing it.
I fully agree. I mean, but the other element is also, and the other element is also the fact that that could be for predicting future decline. Mm-hmm. So we know that after a certain age, and that age actually is fairly young, after age in our 20s, late 20s, we start losing cells. That start losing cells is actually indication that, oh, we have peaked. And we just, from Alzheimer's Association, this other research that was done, that almost in everything, we start declining across age. And the one area that we don't is vocabulary. For majority, it gets better. But everything else decline. And so some people decline more. So if there was one thing I could magically do is give this sense of awareness and urgency to 20 and 30-year-olds. That forget about Alzheimer's. It's about maintaining vibrant brain activity in your 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. And if you do that, Alzheimer's is not going to happen. Or you're going to push it past normal age. But maintaining brain activity, vibrance, is the critical thing. Cell loss, not important because we have way more cells than we need. It's that connectivity. It's the food that we give that shocks the brain. It's the lack of sleep. It also starts accumulating in our 20s and 30s.
So what are those things? If you had to outline them right now, yeah. A lot of our listeners are in their late 20s, early 30s, and so forth. Like, okay, like these are the things you must do.
Yeah. First of all, start eating better.
Yep.
Yeah. And
whole foods, plant-based diet.
Whole food, plant-based diet. I mean, I think there's a controversy, but across the board, when we talk to Plant Paradox?
Gundry
and others, yeah. And mm-hmm. we spoke, I push. You know? Yeah. And he said, and they all say, at the core, it's whole food, plant-based.
Yeah.
Little changes here, little changes, it's whole food, plant-based.
Eat food, not too much, mostly plants.
That's
Michael
it.
Pollan.
Pollan said it all.
Perfect statement.
Yes, yeah. He said it right. Efficiency of language, that's it.
I don't know where he's going with psychedelics. That's another conversation. I don't know if I agree with that one. I haven't read that book, but yeah.
Me either.
But that's it. Whole food, plant-based. And that will be incredible energy source for your brain because to maintain the brain capacity. The second thing is exercise. Mm-hmm. More than you thought.
So what does that mean, more than you thought?
So everybody we talk to, my patients, I say exercise, and all of a sudden they just, I walked the neighborhood. I said, that's fantastic, but that's meditation. You got to get tired. You got to get tired about 25 to 30 minutes a day, 4 to 5 days a week. That's the data, over and over again. And
you got to get tired.
The reason I don't say, measure your pulse and subtract age and all those things, right. Nobody's going to do that. But if you have difficulty finishing a sentence, that's a good measure. Okay. Because that's your measure, isn't it?
But I take the stairs.
That's
everywhere.
It.
Everywhere.
So that's the second. There are three legs, pardon the pun, to exercise.
Yep.
The one is you got to do aerobic exercise at least 25 minutes. That second leg is you have to move throughout the day. Mm-hmm. You have to move throughout the day. Because even if you did half an hour of exercise, but then you sat around the rest of the day, you negated the benefit.
Sedentary behavior is the new smoking.
Yeah.
So move. Use the stairs. Whatever you have to do, get up. The third one is the shocking one, interesting one, sexy one. leg strength is very strongly correlated with brain health. There's a mechanism. I can actually explain, but it would be boring your audience to that. But leg strength.
Squats.
Mm-hmm. Mini squats. Walking the stairs. Biking. Putting a little bike in your living space while you're watching the news, you're angry, you're moving fast, you're just walking, slowly. But then every few commercials, just rev it up, make it part of your living space. I mean, we have memberships in all kinds of gyms, but
you guys like spinning.
We do.
Okay.
We do. Yeah. Biking. I love better than a lot of other things because the brain we forget. We have magical thought that it's in a very bony, rough. A container.
Sure.
So running, I think it does have some effect long term. I've seen, but biking takes away that trauma. biking is not the up and down bouncing. So I love biking for people, and especially if you bring it to your living space, then the excuse, I don't want to go out, I don't want to get dressed, I don't want to do this, that, all of that is gone. You're just watching the news and just slowly going, and every few commercials you rev it up. That's the
maybe
best
maybe not watching the news though.
Yes.
Right. Something else.
Something else. Something yes, else. Yes, yes, yes. Some yeah.
National Geographic.
Okay, that's better.
Yeah. So exercise is critical. Exercise builds. Two things can build the brain. Actually grow the brain. Studies have shown that the hippocampus grows. Remember that after age 20 or so, you start shrinking. Mm-hmm. Exercise actually grows the brain. So whenever people come to us and say, so what are you selling? I'm saying, you're not selling vitamins. You're not selling food. You're not, we're selling for you to, you know, do biking, sleep more, and eat more greens and beans and, you know, vegetables. That's basically it. So, but the exercise component actually grows the brain. That's a critical thing that you should start as early as possible. The other thing exercise does is it actually modulates all your other systems, right, your endocrine and everything else. Your legs are your biggest muscles. In fact, the biggest pump in your body, blood pump, is not your heart, it's your legs. So, and that's why exercise is important. And the third one is sleep.
I would say sleep.
Sleep.
Yeah. We're not getting enough sleep or good sleep. And again, it has to do with just too much stimulus around us and the concept of multitasking.
Sleep tips at night?
Yeah.
Yeah, many. I think you can eliminate need for sleep medication over time, not immediately. We're not against medicine. Medicine should be a bridge. It should not be a stand forever. You know, as doctors, we've learned that it's either pill or knife. Mm-hmm. And we never know how to get people off of things. I say the job of a doctor is to get people off of medicine. So when somebody has high blood pressure, definitely they should take medicine for short term. But what gets rid of blood pressure long term or reverses it is lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So that should be a bridge. Cholesterol medicine should be a bridge. Sleep medicine should be a bridge. But over time, over a year, you can, through sleep hygiene, through cognitive behavioral therapy and other measures, you can completely change your relationship with your sleep.
And so last question, a lot of people, this is a big epidemic. A lot of families are hurting, hits close to home. What advice do you have to people who have a loved one, you know, suffering from cognitive decline, dementia, Alzheimer's, et cetera, or starting to see signs? Like, what advice do you have for those people, those families?
I would tell them to separate the person from the disease. A lot of times we always see the disease. The person is way more than the symptoms. And for people who are hurting, it's important for everyone to remember the good times, the beautiful personality that person is and was. And there are going to be moments where there's going to be a lot of pain and disturbance and stress. One of the good things about dementia and Alzheimer's disease is that it's very easy for the families and loved ones to distract them. We have this one mechanism where, you know, they have a lot of anxiety. So people who go through dementia have a lot of anxiety because slowly you feel slowly and gradually losing parts of yourself. So that's a very high anxiety state to be in. But then you throw in a wrench in that system and remind them of a beautiful memory. And then suddenly they just follow that story and they forget about the anxiety momentarily, but they forget about it. And they start creating that story. They start living in that moment that had happened in the past. And that's quite helpful.
I fully agree. There are two elements to Alzheimer's. One is prevention. Once a person has Alzheimer's, full-blown Alzheimer's, there are people making claims that they can reverse Alzheimer's. That's playing with people's hopes and much more than that, actually dangerous. And we will never make that claim. At this point, nobody can reverse Alzheimer's. Prevention of it is possible. Significantly. But once you have full-blown Alzheimer's, at the best, you can slow it down.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, slow it down. And that's important. But that's the second thing is, how do you manage a person that's going through beginnings of this, where the anxiety and fear, and as I just said, it's important that the family, if possible, the whole family becomes part of this. It's such a growing experience for the rest of the family members, especially youngsters. In my clinic, I bring the whole family. And one time I had a family of 14 people in my clinic, and it's a small little room.
He stole all our chairs. There were like 16 chairs in his room in the office.
And I make sure that it doesn't become a painful, because it's a chronic disease. It's a challenge. It's a family challenge. It's a growing experience for the grandchildren. It's a growing experience for the rest of the family. The number one population that actually suffers from abuse are people who have dementia, fulminant dementia, not because the people are bad, lack of knowledge, lack of resources. And I actually give people knowledge about what are the challenges you will face. When a person reacts a certain way, it's not them, it's the disease. Look what you just did. You just took the disease as, you know, separated from the person, and then build around the beautiful memories. Mm-hmm. You've just taken a disease and made it a family growing experience. And I think it should be in every disease, but especially in Alzheimer's, because otherwise, it's the most painful process to go through alone. Mm-hmm. The caregivers die 60% faster than the patient. Why is that?
Wow.
Because it's that painful. If it's not supported by the rest of the family, by the rest of the community, that's why we're doing the community approach. All the profits from the book are going to go into this Healthy Minds Initiative, where we go into the communities, educating communities. There are communities that don't know anything about Alzheimer's. And for us to, so that's the critical thing. This disease will overwhelm our society, and we have to meet it as a population together and grow with it.
Do you think we'll see a cure in the next 10 years?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was quick. I like that answer. Yes.
No, there's a lot of hope. There's a lot of good work that's been done.
In the meantime, the rest of us cannot focus on gimmicks.
Yep.
Even if it comes from Cher's eyes. Or anybody.
Absolutely.
Don't buy any.
Yeah.
We have to focus on families.
Well, I
and
think
community.
Everyone should still buy your book, but.
Communities.
No, I'm with you.
Yeah, communities are everything. You have created a community, and that's way more powerful than any clinic.
Thank you. We're trying. Well, thank you so much, guys. Dean, Aisha, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.